Once upon a time. Welcome to Australian Book Lovers, your destination for imagination.
Australian Book Lovers acknowledges First Nations peoples and recognises their continuous connection to country, community, and to culture. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and honour the sharing of traditional stories passed down through generations. We're committed to a safe and inclusive welcome for authors and readers of all cultures and backgrounds, including people of LGBTQIA+ communities and their families.
Good evening, everyone. At Australian Book Lovers, our mission is not only about celebrating and sharing fabulous Australian and Indigenous authored books of all genres with readers around the globe, it's about finding fantastic resources and information for authors looking to write their own book, or two, or three. And what better resource than getting into the writer's room with some of those authors and asking them to share their experience. We are on episode 137. I'm Veronica Strachan, aka V.E. Patton, picture book, science fiction, fantasy, memoir, and non-fiction author. And I'm here on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country and with my co-host.
Yes, I, as you, I'll get it out in a minute. Yes, so I am Laurie Bell. I am a science fiction and fantasy writer, author, Friday fictioneer, flash fiction writer, reader of all sorts, wishing I had a picture book that I could talk about tonight. And also coming to you from Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country today.
Fantastic. Now, our listeners tell us that they love to hear what inspires the story in our writers and how it makes it to the page and what happens next. So we are diving into the absolutely brilliant writing worlds of Francis Mackay and Rick Le Couteur. And Rick's going to tell us three different pronunciations of his surname, depending on where we are in the world. But I think I've pitched one not too badly. Now, on the surface, two children's picture book authors who share a love of learning, but who are both so much more than authors. So welcome, Francis and Rick.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Great to be here.
And we'll say it's evening here on the east coast of Melbourne. But Rick, what time is it where you are?
Just after 2 a.m. California time, yes.
Good. And we are very, very thankful for you staying up so late to join us today.
Well, to be honest, I didn't quite stay up. I had a little, sleep before I got
good
up again.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
Lovely. Now, Francis, can we ask you, down in Hobart, you're on to the Palawa people's country down there.
Yes, I think so. I think that's how you pronounce it.
And apologies to our First Nations authors. Now, I'm going to share a little of your bio, if that is okay. And here we go. So Francis Mackay is a teacher, educational writer, and children's book author, as we've mentioned. She was a primary or elementary school teacher for 20 years, working in Australia and the UK. She's the author of over 90 Yes, everybody, 90 educational resource books and is an independent publisher also of picture books, activity books, and non-fiction books. She loves to write books that are fun as well as educational. And I really love your mission, and I'm going to read that out in a little while when we get to that. She currently lives, as we said, on Palawa country in Tasmania. And for those who want to have a look, Francis is F-R-A-N-C-E-S, Mackay is M-A-C-K-A-Y. Join those together, add the .com, and you will find the website of Francis Mackay. And if you're watching on YouTube or Spotify, behind Francis are all of her beautiful stories and all of her beautiful books. And I can see Nate's noisy nose, which we'll talk about a little bit later. So I know Laurie is itching to get the first question in. So, Francis, I'm going to let her away you go.
Well, it was actually, I wish I had this story when I was a little kid, because I was that little kid who when I blow my nose, it's very loud. And
there's even a warning on the cover of the book. I love that.
Joke after joke. Exactly, and about my trumpet nose and how I couldn't blow my nose quietly to save my life. So I just adore this picture book. It is so much fun. What made you come up with this idea?
There's so many people ask me this question, and I, to be honest, the truth is I really don't know. I keep a little notebook beside my bed, and if I'm wake up in the morning, I think of something, and I just came across this story about this kid with a noisy nose. I mean, my husband is a legendary snorer, but it didn't come so much from that. I don't think so, anyway. But I just enjoy writing funny stories, and I love to give adults and children a good laugh because I think that's what we all need, especially these days. And the story just got sillier and sillier as I went along. And the ending is a surprise. So I won't tell you the
No,
ending.
spoilers.
Yes. Oh,
So I can't claim that it came from some great idea. It just developed, I suppose you'd say. Yeah.
there are stories all around us, aren't there?
Yeah, I love it.
All right, now, Rick, originally you were on Wiradjuri country up in Dunedoo in New South Wales, but before you spent time out in California. So let me read everybody your bio as well. So, based on a childhood spent in the rustic charm of rural Australia, Rick's love for animals blossomed into a lifelong career as a veterinarian, educator, and advocate for animal well-being. Currently, as director of education for a company dedicated to introducing people to the wonders of wildlife in remote locations, Rick shares his love and knowledge of animals with enthusiasts of all ages. Through the telling of stories crafted to inspire love, understanding, and advocacy for wildlife, Rick's journey has evolved beyond clinics and teaching into the enchanting realm of children's literature. Through his stories about animals, Rick seeks to cultivate in young readers a sense of curiosity, empathy, and responsibility towards the natural world. Moreover, Rick's narratives serve as a clarion call for environmental stewardship in the face of climate challenges. It is Rick's belief that by nurturing young minds with the mystery and fascination of animals, we can sow the seeds of compassion and a deep reverence for the delicate balance of life on our planet. Through his stories and illustrations, Rick hopes to kindle imagination in young hearts and to inspire a new generation of animal lovers and conservationists. And for those wanting to look up Rick's website, RickLecouteur.com. So Rick Lecouture. Or tell us the other three other pronunciations, Rick.
Well, I think for the main body of this audience, it would just be Rick Lecouter. It's from France, and so if you are able to speak French, it would be Rick Lecouteur. But I answer to anybody and anything, and I'm just thrilled that people notice me. So if you're looking at me and say something that remotely resembles my name, I'll respond
You'll
immediately.
respond. Sounds good. It sounds
Sounds
good.
brilliant.
And we are all about promoting and celebrating Australian authors. So I want to know, retired veterinary surgeon, professor of neurology and neurosurgery, lecturer of Wildlife and Conservation Company, how did you get to children's book author and illustrator?
Very simply, because as you can notice from my bio, I am a man of too many words. Very simply, I was reading books to my grandchildren at bedtime, and I was struck by the fact that penguins were eating pizza and driving cars. And when I asked them authentic questions about the environment of penguins, they were a little bit wanting. So I did some research, and I found that the balance between the whimsical and the authentic or realistic children's picture books is really important. I absolutely agree that kids need to laugh as often as possible. And Francis, your books and the illustrations, you're right. You just inspire laughter, and that's so important for kids. So the whimsical, the fantastical. But there's also a little bit of a need for something more realistic to balance that. And so that's my wannabe niche. And with my background in animals and animal welfare and wildlife, it just seemed logical that I could fill that gap. So I wrote them originally for my grandchildren to fill that gap, hoping that they will become mini conservationists and so on in the future. And in fact, hoping more than that, our generation, the four of us, have done a pretty poor job of taking care of planet Earth, to be honest. And I take partial responsibility for that. And I think the only way I can see us having a future is through the next generation.
And getting them more aware more quickly.
Absolutely. And making them, not making them, that's impossible, but helping them to become enthusiastic about wildlife.
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely. Yeah.
And I have to say, your drawings, Rick, I've been playing on your website, and I'm just in awe of your illustrations. They are absolutely gorgeous.
Well, thank you. They're meticulously time consuming, and I'm never, as a true artist might say, I'm never completely satisfied, but there comes a time where you have to say, it's time to let this go. But thank you very much for the compliment. That
Oh, you're
means a
very
lot.
welcome. Well, I have a niece who, out of all my nieces and nephews, who are all into fantasy and science fiction and into the wonders and everything out there, I have one niece who is very much into the natural world and into animals and wildlife in particular. So I know I will be pointing her in your direction because they are lovely images. Sorry, I'm taking too much time.
Yep.
Go, Veronica.
All right. Francis and Rick, we're going to ask both of you this one. Laurie, I guess the segue is a little is that around the illustrations, but Francis, I know you have many, many teachers' resources and you have all of those educational books which make learning fun. And I am just going to read to people from your website. Your mission is simple: to create books that inspire children's imagination, curiosity, and creativity. And what a fantastic mission. Tell me about, Francis, let's begin with you, how all of those additional resources, because your children's book author, it's not just the book and it's not just the illustrations. There is so much more that goes into shaping that. Tell us a little bit about why that all kind of works together.
Yeah, that's quite a long question, I suppose. I think with all of my books, even with, the silly Nate's noisy nose, there is a sort of a educational aspect to it. So even with my silly story, I've developed science activities to go with it on sounds, because sound and the study of sound is one of the science topics in the curriculum. So in a way, I'd like to help teachers and parents know that they can use a book to develop other educational aspects. I'm not a great one for morals in a story, because I think we've sort of done that to death, really. But taking an aspect like creating a nose machine, a noisy nose machine, or something like that, where they go off and develop something themselves. That's what I aspire to do with the educational resources that I create for my books. So you can go off in all directions: art, you can create puppets, you can write poems, you can do science and technology, and you can draw out loads of things from one little picture book.
Yeah, which is absolutely fantastic. Yeah, for sure. Beautiful. Rick, tell us about yours.
Well, it's so interesting. I've heard all three of you use the term, or the word, curiosity, and I think that's the key to a good kid's book, is to inspire their interest and their curiosity, and the rest is up to them. But boy, what a great start if they become curious. So I think I in both senses of the word, I have been a curious person along the way, and so that's what I hope to convey. I was so thrilled to hear Frances say that she doesn't really subscribe to writing a children's picture book to disseminate a moral. I have said exactly the same thing, and I follow that usually by saying there are some messages in my books, but the word moral is almost dictatorial, and it takes us back to a different generation, certainly not something for the current generation. So I loved that, Frances. I thought that was spot on. And so I write my books. I'm inspired to write my books as an educator. I educated slightly older people my entire life as a university professor teaching neurosurgery to aspiring veterinarians. But teaching and learning really don't have an age limit. It was a shock to me to become aware of the age requirements, or not requirements, but recommendations in the children's book arena. And it wasn't until I started to go to different classes and read to children that I realized it's really, really important. And I notice the age groups that are recommended on Frances's books, and they're very similar to mine, to the target audience, if you like, of my books. But I learned why books are appropriate for certain age groups. I mean, just one of the revelations for me was finding out how children build syllables onto words as they get older and older. And so if you use a 5-syllable word to a 3 to 5-year-old, it's not going to resonate. And so the education has partly been my own in doing this, but I hope some of the messages, Frances, that we convey change the lives of kids and make them look around themselves. And rather than throwing a stone or chasing an Australian white ibis and calling it a nasty name, maybe they will stop and admire that bird and see that they're the most beautiful birds on the planet in their own environment. Not so beautiful when they're picking up after humans in city streets, but that's not their fault. That's absolutely a human inflicted wound. And those birds, if you watch them, they're wonderful parents, they're amazing foragers. And of course, the original Australians used to not worship them in Australia, but take care of them in the wetlands, because they knew, the Aboriginal people knew, that the ibis was cultivating the very land which they were inhabiting. So, and the ibis, of course, has been in Australia much longer than people. My goodness, any people. It's, yes. It's really very kind of the ibis to share Australia with us all. I'll stop, because born with too many words, I'll go on and on.
Well, I was going to say, I do think that picture books do have that ability with particularly the very young, who are looking more at the images than they are necessarily following the words. They're hearing the words and the flow and the lyricy and lyricness of the sounds, but it's those images that capture kids first and foremost. And both of you focus on bringing out that empathy with kids and being in the same with Nate's noisy nose and feeling like everyone's focused on him in a bad way, to the ibis being called names. It brings out that empathy in the children reading your books. I'm gonna jump in real quick and go through the blurbs, because I'm dying to tell you all about these fantastic books. They're so much fun. So the blurb for Nate's Noisy Nose by Frances Mackay and Dottie Colvin. A heartwarming and funny picture book about an ordinary kid with a musical nose. Nate's noisy nose makes him the centre of attention wherever he goes, at home, at school, and out and about, but not always in a good way. Amid the chaos, Nate's longing for peace grows stronger. If only he could find silence and slip under the radar like a regular kid. Nate's loyal furry friend, Rascal, is by his side, ready to help him snuffle out solutions. Will Rascal's devotion be the key to Nate's noisy problem, or will the team of brilliant doctors and scientists come to the rescue? This noisy, interactive book is more than just a funny tale of a musical nose. It's a celebration of friendship, loyalty, creativity, and finding solutions when life gets a little too loud.
It is.
Oh,
yes.
My God.
It I is love just it delightful. So
much. And I'll go quickly into Nasty Names Are Hurtful by Rick Lakuta. In Nasty Names Are Hurtful, an Australian white ibis responds to name calling in the city. Meet Penny, an Australian white ibis navigating city life after human-induced changes disrupt her natural wetland habitat. Despite her graceful nature, Penny faces relentless mockery and name calling from fellow birds who label her bin chicken and picnic pirate due to her scavenging behaviour in urban settings. Enduring this hurtful ridicule, Penny conceals her emotions while reflecting on the circumstances that forced her family into the cityscape, yearning for their lost wetland home. A poignant narrative that sheds light on the repercussions of human intervention on wildlife and underscores the value of empathy and acceptance. Through Penny's resilient journey, young readers learn valuable lessons on embracing differences and the far-reaching impact of thoughtless behaviour. Nasty Names Are Hurtful serves as a compelling exploration of resilience and compassion resonating with readers of all ages.
So very, very similar themes in both books.
Yes, absolutely. Aren't they just? That's it. And it struck me that these are two people that needed to, you know, we needed to explore their writing journeys because, yeah, your messages are there and so strong, which is fantastic. Yeah. Let's go, if we could, just a little to the, I guess, some of the mechanics. Tell me, Frances, how do you choose your illustrators? Obviously, you've had so many different books and you would no doubt want exactly the right person to bring that story to life because, as Laurie was saying, you know, you find that the images are a story in themselves. How do you work with your publishers and find the right illustrator?
Well, I am the publisher, so that was
excellent. Sorry, yes, with these ones, indeed you are fantastic.
But finding an illustrator is just so tricky for a picture book. I did get sample illustrations from several illustrators, and they didn't depict Nate as I wanted him. I wanted definitely a cartoony type character, and I wanted to work with the same illustrator that I used for my other book called Baby Worries, but she is a very expensive illustrator, and I thought, oh gosh, can I afford her? But after looking at the samples, I knew they just weren't hitting the mark. They weren't funny enough. And it does take quite a lot of skill to do a funny illustration. And so I went with Dottie, who did my Baby Worries book, and she is absolutely amazing. And she is a cartoonist originally, so she brings a lot of humour to every illustration. There's lots of things in the illustrations that you can find that are just hilarious, you know. So
almost like Easter eggs in computer games, isn't it? There you go, oh, look at, and each time you look at those pictures, you see a little bit more.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah, fantastic. So let's look at the transition to indie, because when you originally started with a lot of your educational books, you were working with, I think, I can't remember exactly, but it was Scholastic and a couple of other of the big publishers. But then getting into the more, you know, the switch or the transition to entertaining and fun books, you decided to go as your own publisher. Tell us a little bit about that kind of evolution.
Well, I started when I was teaching. I started writing articles for Scholastic magazines. And then they commissioned me to write educational books. And it's a total different style of writing to write a teacher's resource book. And in those days, it was easier to get a publisher because they just commissioned me all the time. And once you get on board to one publisher, they tend to just stick with you and they ask you to write. But I've also written for about 8 or 9 other publishers. It was actually the pandemic that made me look into independent publishing, because I have an autoimmune disease. I was stuck at home, you know, more than other people, and I started to look into producing things myself. But I had also had 10 years experience in the UK with my own publishing company, but it was an educational publishing company, so it was different altogether. So I had experience. I knew what a good book looked like, or how you made a good book with the cover design and how it was laid out inside and so on. But I had a lot to learn about writing a story, even though I'd written stories right from when I was in year 5. Still got them.
Oh, brilliant.
Oh, wow.
That's fantastic.
Oh, that is lovely.
Wow.
Yeah, I had a teacher in my year 5 group who encouraged me to write little books for the classroom. So I've always had that yearning to write one. But it was also technology that enabled this to happen, with the same of a lot of independent authors. We didn't have the technology before. You couldn't do it before. You couldn't produce your own book. I know when I had my own publishing company, you had to print at least 2,000 copies of each book, because there was no print-on-demand printing. It was all offset printers in those days. So it was technology. And the fact that the internet allowed you to have online webinars and courses and training, and I could read up lots of things, and things like we're doing now by Zoom, you could talk to people across the world and learn. So after spending a lot of money on webinars and training, I started to learn the craft of writing a picture book, and it was quite a journey. It was really exciting. And great fun. I just love designing books myself as well. So a combination of COVID, the pandemic, and technology, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a fabulous recipe for obviously some great success.
Well, it's the hard part is marketing.
Oh, yes. Oh, we all love marketing.
Rick, then, your illustrations, so they're all made by yourself, so you're writer and illustrator. How did that journey come about, going from a surgeon and professor and veterinary into book writing?
Well, I think an educator is always an educator. You can put them in different places, but you can't take the educator out of them, or the teacher, or whichever term you like to use. And so for me, starting this wildlife company with my friend Carol Walton, who's also a veterinarian living in Texas, I became a photographer. And I don't call myself a wildlife photographer, because those people are in a class of their own. And I would love to be that, but that takes too many years, and I don't have that enough years left. Not to suggest picture books aren't exactly the same. I'm worried I don't have enough years left to reach my goals of reaching as large an audience as possible. That's my only goal, is to get the message out to as many children as I possibly can, because I'm such an advocate for environment and biodiversity and wildlife. So I started to lead these expeditions to Borneo and the Antarctica and India and beyond, many, many different countries, and was watching people around me taking these beautiful photographs. We had a lot of wildlife, we have a lot of wildlife photographers who join our trips. They're small group trips, and so it's ideal for them. And I started to watch, and I caught the virus or the bug. And bought a camera, and then bought another camera, and then another camera, until my wife finally pointed out, you know, it's probably not the camera, it's the person behind the camera. Maybe you should stay with one camera and learn to be good at it. And that was the best advice I ever had, coming from a woman, of course. And so I had all these photographs, and then the experience with my grandkids and the whimsical, and on the environmental side, not being able to put the two together. They couldn't, they knew about Antarctica and they loved books like Tony Baloney, Penguin Pen Pal, and so on. But they couldn't make the transition to put the facts with the fiction, if you like. That's a fairly broad statement. So that's, as I've said already, that's where I decided there was room for a for an old university professor to make a contribution. So I then started to use my illustrations as a basis. My original intent was to use my photographs to guide an illustrator, Francis. So, but I then, I have a very, very best friend who's in Australia, who's a children's book illustrator. And I noticed what was involved with that. And the authenticity was what I was after. So I learned to take my photographs and to digitally transform them, not using AI, artificial intelligence, but meticulously by hand with a tablet and a pen, and turn them into the illustrations. And so I figured it can't get more authentic than that, to take an actual picture and then translate it to the page. So that's the story of that. I loved what Francis said about, I mean, having run the gamut of the publishing world, Francis, to come back to indie publishing, I think, and I love the way you described it, so many of my own stories were, I could have woven them into your story, because I'm inspired by my inspiration, although it might change after reading Francis's books, has always been Beatrix Potter, Jemima Puddle Duck, and Peter Rabbit, and you know,
you can see yes, Jeremy Fisher on the shelf there. Yeah. For those who are listening, Francis has a beautiful little stuffed toy, Jeremy Fisher, which of course is the tale of Jeremy Fisher by Beatrix Potter.
Yeah, and so Beatrix was, in my opinion, the first bona fide independently published author. And she did that, as Francis has alluded to, she did that at a time where, well, women didn't publish, and certainly they didn't publish their own books. But her story is well told, and it's worth reading, because she did her own illustrations, of course. And so she was my inspiration. I thought, I can do this. Now, just as a caveat to that, little did I know that in the USA alone, 250 or 300,000 new children's picture books appear every year. And that writing a wonderful picture book and illustrating it either yourself or through an illustrator is enough of a journey. However, and I just assumed everybody would want one.
Didn't we course, all, Mick?
Yeah, that was a rude awakening. Everybody may want one, but if they don't know about them, they can't possibly want it. Yeah. So I moved into the world of marketing and promotion, which is so far from my main interest that I just decided that I'm going to continue, because I love to write. I've gone from writing scientific articles about innovative treatments for brain tumors in humans to writing about the Australian white ibis, which, for anybody listening who doesn't remember, it's an Australian white ibis is a native Australian bird. You can't, so many communities want to get rid of them, in their words, because they're a little bit messy as they pick up the human waste and rubbish to survive, and as we take away more and more of their habitat. But this magnificent bird is protected. You can't get rid of an ibis. I've been dealing with a community around the El Alamein Fountain in Sydney who want the ibis eradicated from the streets. It's not quite that simple. My suggestion in return was that we eradicate the humans and turn the fountain into a wetland. So I've been arguing with the local council, who, by the way, are on of a similar opinion to me, and I hesitate to say us, that the ibis deserves to have its own habitat and go back to where it, as close to where it was as it possibly can. So the council has been advocates for finding the balance between urban living and these animals that are so magnificent and need wetlands. Anyway, I
That's all
digressed once again,
right.
and so that's my
That's okay.
mission with the illustrations, is to introduce the kids to the reality of. Yeah, I can I show a book to everybody?
You can, and we'll have to talk about
Yes.
it for our listeners, but yes.
May I? It's illustrated by a very good friend of mine, who's 40 years ago, whose dog I saved from a spinal injury. Saved sounds a little bit over the top. I treated for a spinal injury, and his name is Bruce Whatley, and he does or many of the illustrations for Jackie French's books. And you
Yes.
may be familiar with this one. This one's Play. And look how he depicts the Australian white ibis. It's just absolutely
Yes.
beautiful. And
And when you
he
see them in the wild, they are just absolutely glorious because that's where they belong.
And he makes the point of human intervention by including the trees that were chopped down, as well as the wetlands that were lost. And then he moves to the modern day, where the ibis is scavenging in a bin. I learned the most about the Australian ibis through a visit to the Australian Museum when I was returning some Aboriginal artifacts that had been in my family for hundreds of years, literally. And I didn't think we should have them. So when they finally came down to me, I gave them back to where they belong. And it's been such a great story. That's a book in itself, to have them returned. They actually found the original place that these boomerangs came from and returned them to the local people. So I see a lot of parallels between the story of the ibis and the story of the Australian Aboriginal. And when you think about it, and you think that how we manage both situations today, there are so many similarities and so many parallel points to be made that I didn't want to talk about that very much with the kids. But do you know, have you heard of Uncle Jimmy, who's affiliated with the Australian Museum? He is probably one of the foremost Aboriginal advocates for the Australian white ibis, and he was the inspiration. Next time people who listen to this podcast look at an ibis, I hope they might see it just a
See it
little bit
differently.
differently.
That's absolutely fine to share your passion, and that is what it's all about. And now Frances is going to share her passion. Tell us about the collaboration, the new initiative that you have, Frances.
Well, it's a good point, as Rick has discovered. You can write a fantastic book, it can be beautifully illustrated, and if nobody knows about it, then you won't sell one. So I'm a really strong advocate for independent authors. I've stopped calling them self-published because they have such a bad name in the publishing world. And rightly so, a lot of the time, because there are a lot of very poorly produced books. You know, a lot of people think, oh, well, I'll just throw this book together, I'll plop it up on Amazon, and, you know, I won't have it edited, I won't get it illustrated properly. And there are a lot of poorly produced books. But I wanted to sort of, my other mission, if you like, is to prove to the world, and Australian teachers in particular, and Australian parents, that there are a lot of really good self-published, or what I call independent or micro publishers. So I set out about 6 or 8 months ago to find these authors and to look at their books and see the quality of them. And I've brought together 37 Australian independent authors. Most of them are picture books, but there are chapter books as well. And we've all created resources to go with the book. And that was quite a journey because a lot of the authors had never done that. So I had to help them do that and create them. And then we've put together, I know that Veronica and Laurie and Rick can see this, but we've put together a catalogue where we can actually show the teachers.
That's fantastic. So it's got a
book and the resources to go with the book. And we've created a catalogue. This is a printed version of it. That's my Nate's Noisy Nose page.
Excellent.
But we've put it online as well so that
brilliant.
Teachers can access it online. They can download the PDF and then they can order the books. So there's loads of themes. There's loads of nature themes, Rick. There's lots of ones that are doing really good stuff with nature, Australian animals. And we are trying to market ourselves as a group, like a collaborative, really, to try and get our word out there into the world so that people can know that we're there and we've got some really good books. Wow. But it's hard work. Hard work getting the message out.
I imagine it would be, Frances, for new teachers in particular, that would be such a rich resource to see all of those things that they could do with a single book.
Yes, yeah, it is.
Yeah. Where can people find it? Where can people find the catalogue?
Well, the actual, it's not a website, it's a landing page where they can download it. It's called booksforteachers.mailer.com. So it's an actual landing page where they can go in, they can put in their email and then download the PDF. So we're trying to spread this URL out everywhere on social media and so on. And you've made a really good point about teacher colleges and training universities and so on. We're trying to reach those people. We're trying to reach people who do homeschooling, parents who want to do educational things with their kids at home, teacher librarians. So with 37 of us trying to market the catalogue, we're trying to have some sort of impact. We just hope it works. It may not, but we're going to try.
So all those teachers that are listening into the podcast today, get on this. It looks absolutely amazing and these books are a fantastic resource. And a lot of fun stories as well.
Yes, yeah.
Can I just ask you about your writing process? So, you know, we've had you hammering on your books and there's obviously a broad continuum of people that are really disciplined and people that just write. And you've mentioned, Frances, that Nate's Noisy Nose, you're not even sure where it came from, where the muse struck you, it just was there. But what about your writing habits with so many books under your belt? What's your writing day look like?
Well, this is my office. I have lots of inspiration around me. I use a laptop and a notebook. I do tend to write things down. Maybe that's my age. I do tend to write things out and plan it out. I don't necessarily know where the ending's going to be, what the ending is. I'm not a planner to that degree. I know some people actually plan the whole thing out, but I tend to write and then ideas keep coming to me. Mm-hmm. And then often I will then send it to an editor, a good editor, and they will just tear it apart and say, well, you should have done this and you should have done that.
Oh,
so you write the whole thing again. And sometimes I'll use two or three different editors and you get totally different feedback from all of them. And you get different ideas. You send them out to beta readers and they share their ideas. So it takes a long time. And picture books, you know, they only have about 800 to a 1,000 words. So you've got to really chop down those sentences and make every word count. So it's quite a long process. A lot of people think, oh, a picture book, that must be easy.
Wouldn't 500 that be words,
easy? You could do that in a day.
So but not.
You
I know I've asked Veronica this. Do you start with the, Frances, do you start with the images in your head or do you start with the story and then the images form as you go? What's your process from that point of view?
Sometimes when I'm lying in bed, I have a movie playing in my head and it's brilliant. It's really exciting. And when I write it down, it doesn't sound so good. So, yes, I do have images, but if you mean the illustrator images, no, that's totally up to the illustrator. So she takes the words and she created Nate and she created the dog and all the other characters in the story. So you've got to let the illustrator run with it, really, because they pull out things that you would never have thought of, really.
Do they ever make you change the words once you've seen the illustrations?
Yes, sometimes, yeah.
Okay, so there's a little bit there.
Interesting.
Yeah. Rick, what about you?
Well, how
Rick,
do I,
with your illustrations.
Your writing process. Tell us about your writing process.
Yeah, well, I with 90 plus books and Frances's experience and background, I hesitate to participate in this part of the conversation.
No, everyone has a journey. Books. Everyone has a journey.
Probably sends her back to the beginning. I am motivated by sleep and water. So my best ideas, I loved that Frances said she keeps a pen and paper here and there because like Frances, if I don't write it down in that moment, you can't recapture some of these thoughts. And so that's the beginning. Inspiration comes from water and sleep. And I wake up in the morning, I head straight to my pen and pencil and write things down. I know that Frances has a blog on her website. I'm an active blogger, or at least have been for 6 months, and certainly find it's a wonderful way to get thoughts out. And I think some of the blogs will ultimately, if I am able to find a way, will become books. But my books, my process, I don't, like Frances, I don't have an end point in mind. I often have an idea. I mean, with the Ibis book, for example, I wanted to make the point that they're a beautiful bird and that there are other things that we can do other than call them nasty names. And then the thought grew to recognize that my grandson had come home from school recently and complained that somebody was calling him names. And so it all just evolved. But like Frances, I have a wonderful editor, and I my first two books were written without an editor, and I really understand what an editor can do. And so Bethany, my editor, I shouldn't say my editor, she is by no means mine, but the editor who reads my books, she fulfills a really important purpose, and she will comment on the illustrations as well. So my illustrations are a little bit more difficult to change from the authentic, but I can find a different one that fits the page a little bit better. And so the process for me, I would describe in one word as a little bit, it's random, but there's method to the madness. And I've got to just say, as Frances talks, I hear behind her words this same passion that drives me, and maybe not expressed with as many words as I use, but it's just so wonderful, Frances, to meet somebody who has done so many of the things that I would aspire to do, one or two of them in my lifetime, and to know that there's hope.
Yes.
With hard work and imagination, there's
passion,
hope. So
assistance.
I'm going to continue writing because my day isn't complete till I've spent a few hours writing. And It's so great to be able to write about things that are not necessarily data-based or data-based over here.
Yes.
Well, scientific writing are very rigid requirements. And
yes, and, writing in the third person very dispassionately, no emotion. It's, yes, coming from a health background, Rick, I absolutely medical appreciate job. It took me a long time to relax to write fiction.
Yeah. So okay. I've got to just say, the three of you have, if I needed it, I just flying high on the inspiration I'm getting from talking to three bona fide authors, a group that I am, as I say, wanting to join. And it's just so exciting for me.
Excellent. And it's not exhausting speaking. Feeling,
I'm sorry?
It's not exhaustion because it's 2 o'clock in the morning over there.
No. I'm energized. I'm going to have trouble getting back to sleep.
Well, you all inspire me because I'd love to write a picture book being an ex-prep teacher and a reception teacher over in the UK and love reading picture books with the kids and talking about them and breaking them down and what do you think this means and where does this take you? And it is an insanely detailed skill that you have as picture book artists and writers and storytellers, because it's a huge thing. The kids are looking at the pictures. That's what's telling them the story. But they're hearing the words that you're, a lot of the additional words that maybe are not written, but they're hearing them and they're seeing those journeys. And it's that empathy of understanding that bird's upset. I feel that too. Kids have picked on me or you know, yeah, my nose is so loud when I blow it and everyone laughs when I do. And yes, that's a personal story, but it is very much that's what the kids are there getting from these picture books. They're such an important resource.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
the pictures are often telling a different story.
Yes, aren't they? Yes, yeah. The two threads, the illustrator and the author.
My favorite thing to do after all these years of teaching is to read one of my books to a classroom of fourth or fifth graders and to listen to their questions. And the schools in America, when a guest author comes in and reads to a class, they are asked to draw a picture after the event, so the activities side of it, and to write down a few things that they learned from the experience. And I have found those to be the most insightful and telling critiques, much more insightful than Bethany, the editor I use.
they share no warts, is it? Children, no. They tell you how it is.
They tell you.
and that's been fantastic. And particularly I have presented my books to a couple of special needs classes, and I would like to do more of those. Picture books really, I've seen it with my own eyes and experienced it. Picture books really are a bridge for teachers to use to reach some of these children who, through no fault of their own, have difficulty functioning in what we call the real world. I mean, I don't know what that even is anymore, but their world is what they need to function in. And picture books have such an important role. And that inspires me too, I have to say.
Well, I used to use picture books with my 10 and 11-year-old classes, you know, older children. And this is something that parents don't really get either. They think if it's a picture book, oh, that's for babies. He's got to be reading a chapter book. Well, it's not, because you can learn, even as an adult, you can still enjoy a picture book.
Yeah. Especially as an adult.
Yeah. I love picture books.
I do too.
There's so much more in them. But what's been one of the best responses you've had, Frances, in the classroom?
Oh gosh. Well, one I do remember was reading The Muddled-Headed Wombat. I don't know whether you know
Yes, know
that
that one. Yep.
And the illustrations I was reading, and the children, it wasn't actually a picture book, it had pictures in it, but it wasn't a straight picture book. And I could see what was coming in the illustration, and I just burst into laughter, and I had tears streaming down my eyes. I couldn't get the words out. All the kids were just looking at me, and they all started laughing, and we all just fell apart. And I couldn't even finish the story. That's something that sticks in my mind. That happened years and years
That's
ago.
fantastic.
It's just having that bond with the children, and this is with parents and their own children as well. If you giggle together and you laugh together and you talk about it together, you never forget it. It stays with you forever. So there should be just so much more fun in the world, especially with
Absolutely.
primary age children. I think the world is
Yes.
getting far too serious
Yes.
at a very young age. And I hate what's happening in school. The level of knowledge that they expect a 4-year-old to know and a 5-year-old. They just need to play and have fun
Just
and,
be
yes, learn
kids.
to read the basics, lovely.
Be kids.
Yeah, they need to be kids.
And
It's
I will say that
a
my
different
adult
world.
children, it is, but my adult children still say that they loved me doing the voices. I always did voices better than dad. So, even though I worked full time, they would wait for me to come home
Winning, winning.
and do that. All right, our time is really well
Yes.
and truly there. So, Frances, what advice for somebody wanting to write a picture book? What is your nugget? Give me one or two little nuggets there.
I would say research, research, research.
Okay, three.
Read loads of picture books and find out as much as you can, and then just get it down, really. Just write and enjoy it and have fun with it. And you may come up with a great story. You may not, but just keep writing and just put the effort in. But you have to learn a fair bit before you try and publish something or send it off to a publisher or whatever. So it's a long process, as anything is, but like learning to draw or learning to take photographs, Rick.
Yes.
You can't just do it willy-nilly, but just have fun.
Love that.
Beautiful advice, Rick.
Oh, I have
Advice
three
for
words
Frances.
too that I use to cover lots of situations, but I mean, I'm really discovering that I used to teach the students in vet school this when we were talking about treating a brain trauma patient. I would say there are three things that you must put to the forefront: patience, persistence, and time, because recovering from a brain injury takes a lot of time. I've found that those three words, patience, persistence, and time, apply to my children's books. And that's actually the time is what really resonates with me. I'm willing to put as much time as it takes, as many years as it takes to achieve my goal, which is, can I tell you what my true goal is?
Tell us.
My true goal in doing this comes from when I was a little boy and my mother used to go shopping in downtown Sydney. And as a little boy from the bush, that was just amazing. But she would come down to go to David Jones and some of the big stores because we didn't have little stores in our little country town. And she would park me in the basement of Dimmock's bookstore in George Street, which is the children's section. And I would be there reading those books when she got back. And my reward was for being a good boy that I could choose one. And so my absolute goal in doing this, beyond the things we've discussed, which are the true goals, but my personal, selfish, self-centered goal is to go into Dimmock's bookstore and see my book on the shelf. That would be, and your books are already there, Francis. And so I would love to see one of my books beside one of yours. That would be, that would be nirvana for me. Maybe there's one thing that would top that. That would be to see a kid laughing and reading one of my books.
Dimmock's
bookstore.
Yeah. The echoes of the.
So there you go.
That's a good goal, Rick. Hang on to that one and keep chipping away at it.
Well, every time I go to Australia, I sneak into Dimmock's and pretend it's happened. So.
one day it will. Don't you worry about that.
All right. We are going to say good night to everybody. Please remember to read
more
Aussie books.
Three. Okay. Thank you so much to Francis Mackay and to Rick Locuteur for being our wonderful guest tonight.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Let's meet again. Magic happens.